didn't pick up his mail very often. He'd given a street address when obtaining the box, but that address, it turned out, was to an Italian bakery several blocks away. And the phone number was a dud, evidently made up for the purpose. Sure as hell this guy's a spook, Sullivan thought aloud, wondering why the Foreign Counterintelligence Group hadn't picked up the case.
Sure wiggles like one, Chatham agreed.
And their assignment ended right there. They had no evidence of a crime for the subject, and not enough manpower to assign an agent to watch the P.O. box around the clock. Security was good here, Popov thought, as he rode around in another of the military-type vehicles that Dawson called a Hummer. The first thing about security was to have defensive depth. That they had. It was 10 kilometers at least before you approached a property line. It used to be a number of large farms, but Horizon bought them all out a few years ago and started building the research lab. It took a while, but it's finished now.
You still grow wheat here?
Yeah, the facility itself doesn't use all that much of the land, and we try to keep the rest of it the way it was. Hell, we grow almost enough wheat for all the people at the lab. Got our own elevators and all over that way. He pointed to the north. Popov looked that way and saw the massive concrete structures some distance away. It was amazing how large America was, Dmitri Arkadyevich thought. And this part seemed so flat, not unlike the Russian steppes. The land had some dips and rises, but all they seemed to do was emphasize the lack of a real hill anywhere. The Hummer went north and eventually crossed a rail line that evidently led to the grain silos. Elevators, Dawson had called them. Elevators? Why that word? Farther north, and he could barely make out traffic moving on a distant highway. That's the northern border, Dawson explained, as they passed into non-farm land.
What's that?
Oh, that's our little herd of pronghorn antelopes. Dawson turned the wheel slightly to go closer. The Hummer bumped over the grassy land.
They're pretty animals.
That they are, and very fast. We call 'em the speed goat. Not a true antelope at all, genetically closer to goats. Those babies can run at 40 miles an hour, and do it for damn near an hour. They also have superb eyesight.
Difficult to hunt, I imagine. Do you hunt?
They are, and I'm not. I'm a vegan.
What?
Vegetarian. I don't eat meat or other animal products, Dawson said somewhat proudly. Even his belt was made of canvas rather than leather.
Why is that, David? Popov asked.
He'd never come across anyone like him before.
Oh, just a choice I made.
I don't approve of killing animals for food or any other reason, he turned.
Not everybody agrees with me, not even here at the project. But I'm not the only one who thinks that way. Nature is something to be respected, not exploited.
So you don't buy your wife a fur coat, Popov said, with a smile.
He had heard about those fanatics.
Not hardly, Dawson laughed.
I've never hunted, Popov said next, wondering what response he'd get. I never saw the sense in it, and in Russia they've nearly exterminated most game animals.
So I understand. That's very sad, but they'll come back some day, Dawson pronounced.
How, with all the state hunters working to kill them?
That institution hadn't ended even with the demise of communist rule.
Dawson's face took on a curious expression, one Popov had seen many times before at KGB. The man knew something he was unwilling to say right now, though what he knew was important somehow.
Oh, there's ways, pal. There's ways.
The driving tour required an hour and a half, at the end of which Popov was mightily impressed with the size of the facility. The approach road to the building complex was an airport, he saw, with electronic instruments to guide airplanes in and traffic lights to warn autos off when flight operations were in progress.
he asked Dawson about it.
"Yeah, it is kind of obvious, isn't it? You can get a G in and out of here pretty easy. They say you can bring in real commercial jets, too, medium-sized ones, but I've never seen that done."
Dr. Breitling spent a lot of money to build this establishment.
"That he did," Dawson agreed.
"But it's worth it, trust me."
He drove up the highway runway to the lab building and stopped.
"Come with me."
Popoff followed without asking why. He'd never appreciated the power of a major American corporation. This could and should have been a government facility, with all the land and the huge building complex. The hotel building in which he'd spent the night could probably hold thousands of people. And why build such a place here? Was Breitling going to move his entire corporation here? All his employees? So far from major cities, airports, all the things that civilization offered. Why here? Except, of course, for security. It was also far from large police agencies, from news media and reporters. For the purposes of security, this facility might as easily have been on the moon. The lab building was also larger than it needed to be, Dimitri thought. But, unlike the others, it appeared to be functioning at the moment. Inside was a desk, and a receptionist who knew David Dawson. The two men proceeded unimpeded to the elevators, then up to the fourth floor, and right to an office.
"Hi, Doc," Dawson said. "This is Dimitri. Dr. Breitling sent him to us last night."
"He's going to be here a while," the security chief added.
"I got the facts."
The physician stood and extended his hand to Popoff.
"Hi, I'm John Kilgore. Follow me."
And the two of them went through a side door into an examining room, while Dawson waited outside. Kilgore told Popoff to disrobe down to his underwear, and proceeded to give him a physical examination, taking blood pressure, checking eyes and ears and reflexes, prodding his belly to make sure that the liver was non-palpable, and finally taking 4 test tubes of blood for further examination. Popoff submitted to it all without objection, somewhat bemused by the whole thing, and slightly intimidated by the physician, as most people were. Finally, Kilgore pulled a vial from the medicine cabinet and stuck a disposable syringe into it.
"What's this?" Dmitry Arkadyevich asked.
"Just a booster shot," Kilgore explained, setting the vial down. Popoff picked it up and looked at the label, which read B-2100, 11-2100, and nothing else. Then he winced when the needle went into his upper arm. He'd never enjoyed getting shots.
"There, that's done," Kilgore said.
"I'll talk to you tomorrow about the blood work." With that done, he pointed his patient to the hook his clothing hung on. It was a pity, Kilgore thought, that the patient couldn't be appreciative for having his life saved.
"He might as well not exist," Special Agent Sullivan told his boss. "Maybe somebody comes in to check his mail, but not in the past 9 or 10 days."
"What can we do about that?"
"If you want, we can put a camera and motion sensor inside the box like the FCI guys do to cover dead drops."
"We can do it, but it costs money and manpower to keep an agent or two close if the alarm goes off."
"Is this case that important?"
"Yes, it is now," the assistant special agent in charge of the New York Field Division told his subordinate. "Gus Werner started this one off, and he's keeping a personal eye on the case file. So talk to the FCI guys and get them to help you cover the P.O. box."
Sullivan nodded and concealed his surprise.
"Okay, we'll do."
"Next, what about the Bannister case?"
"Well, that's not going anywhere at the moment. The closest thing to a hit we've gotten to this point is the second interview with this Kirk McLean guy. He acted a little antsy.
Maybe just nerves on his part, maybe something else. We have nothing on him and the missing victim, except that they had drinks and talked together at this bar uptown. We ran a background on him. Nothing much to report. Makes a good living for Horizon Corporation. He's a biochemist by profession. Graduated University of Delaware, master's degree, working toward a doctorate at Columbia. Belongs to some conservation groups, including Earth First and the Sierra Club. Gets their periodicals. His main hobby is backpacking. He has 22 grand in the bank, and he pays his bills on time. His neighbors say he's quiet and withdrawn. Doesn't make many friends in the building. No known girlfriends. He says he knew Mary Bannister casually. Walked her home once. No sexual involvement. And that's it, he says. Anything else? The ASAC asked. The flyers the NYPD handed out haven't developed into anything yet. I can't say that I'm very hopeful at this point. What's next, then? Sullivan shrugged. In a few more days, we're going back to McLean to interview him again. Like I said, he looked a little bit hinky, but not enough to justify coverage on him. I talked to this Lieutenant D'Alessandro. He's thinking there might be a serial killer working that part of town. Maybe so. There's another girl missing, Ann Pretlow's her name. But nothing's turning on that one either. Nothing for us to work with. We'll keep scratching away at it, Sullivan promised. If one of them's out there, sooner or later, he'll make a mistake. But until he did, more young women would continue to disappear into that particular black hole, and the combined forces of the NYPD and the FBI couldn't do much to stop it. I've never worked a case like this before. I have, the ASAC said. The Green River Killer in Seattle. We put a ton of resources on that one, but we never caught the mutt, and the killings just stopped. Maybe he got picked up for burglary or robbing a liquor store. And maybe he's sitting it out in a Washington State prison, waiting to get paroled so he can take down some more hookers. We have a great profile on how his brain works, but that's it. And we don't know what brain the profile fits. These cases are real head-scratchers. Kirk McLean was having lunch just then, sitting in one of the hundreds of New York delicatessens, eating egg salad and drinking a cream soda. So? Henriksen asked. So they came back to talk to me again, asking the same fucking questions over and over, like they expect me to change my story. Did you? The former FBI agent asked. No, there's only one story I'm going to tell, and that's the one I prepared in advance. How did you know that they might come to me like this? McLean asked. I used to be FBI. I've worked cases, and I know how the Bureau operates. They are very easy to underestimate, and then they appear. No, then you appear on the scope, and they start looking. And mainly they don't stop looking until they find something, Henriksen said, as a further warning to this kid. So where are they now? McLean asked. The girls, I mean. You don't need to know that, Kirk. Remember that. You do not need to know. Okay. McLean nodded his submission. Now what? They'll come to see you again. They've probably done a background check on you, and what's that mean? Talk to your neighbors, co-workers, check your credit history, your car, whether you have tickets, any criminal convictions. Look for anything that suggests that you could be a bad guy, Henriksen explained. There isn't anything like that on me, Kirk said. I know. Henriksen had done the same sort of check himself. There was no sense in having somebody with a criminal past out breaking the law in the name of the project. The only black mark against him was McLean's membership in Earth First, which was regarded by the Bureau almost as a terrorist, well, extremist, organization. But all McLean did with that bunch was to read their monthly newsletter. They had a lot of good ideas, and there was talk in the project about getting some of them injected with the B vaccine. But they had too many members whose ideas of protecting the planet were limited to driving nails into trees, so that the buzzsaws would break. That sort of thing only chopped up workers in sawmills and raised the ire of the ignorant public without teaching them anything useful. That was the problem with terrorists, Henriksen had known for years. Their actions never matched their aspirations. Well, they weren't smart enough to develop the resources they needed to be effective. You had to live in the economic ecostructure to achieve that, and they just couldn't compete on that battlefield. Ideology was never enough. You needed brains and adaptability, too. To be one of the elect, you had to be worthy. Kirk McLean wasn't really worthy, but he was part of the team. And now he was rattled by the attention of the FBI. All he had to do was stick to his story. But he was shook up, and that meant he couldn't be trusted. So they'd have to do something about it. Get your stuff packed. We'll move you out to the project tonight. What the hell? It would be starting soon anyway. Very soon, in fact. Good, McLean responded, finishing his egg salad. Henriksen was eating pastrami, he saw. Not a vegan. Well, maybe someday. Artwork was finally going up on some of the blank walls. So, Popov thought, the facility wasn't to be entirely soulless. It was nature paintings, mountains, forests, and animals. Some of the pictures were quite good, but most of them were ordinary, the kind of thing you found on the walls of cheap motels. How strange, the Russian thought, that with all the money they'd spent to build this monstrous facility in the middle of nowhere, that the artwork was second-rate. Well, taste was taste, and Breitling was a technocrat, and doubtless uneducated in the finer aspects of life. In ancient times he would have been a druid, Dmitri thought, a bearded man in a long white robe who worshipped trees and animals and sacrificed virgins on stone altars to his pagan beliefs. There were better things to do with virgins. There was such a strange mixture of the old and the new in this man, and his company. The director of security was a vegan, who never ate meat. What rubbish! Horizon Corporation was a world leader in several vital new technological areas, but it was peopled by madmen of such primitive and strange beliefs. He supposed it was an American affectation. Such a huge country, the brilliant coexisting with the mad. Breitling was a genius, but he'd hired Popov to initiate terrorist incidents. And then he'd brought Popov here. Dmitri Arkadyevich thought about that as he chewed his dinner. Why here? What was so special about this place? Now he could understand why Breitling had shrugged off the amount he'd transferred to the terrorists. Horizon Corporation had spent more paving one of the access roads than all the money Popov had taken from the corporate coffers and translated into his own. But this place was important. You could see that in every detail, down to the revolving doors that kept the air inside. Every doorway he'd seen was like some sort of airlock, and made him think of a spacecraft. Not a single dollar had been spared to make this facility perfect. But perfect for what? Popov shook his head and sipped at his tea. The quality of the food was excellent. The quality of everything was excellent, except the absurdly pedestrian artwork. There was, therefore, not a single mistake here. Breitling was not the sort of man to compromise on anything, was he? Therefore, Dmitri Arkadyevich told himself, everything here was deliberate, and everything fit into a pattern, from which he could discern the purpose of the building and the man who directed it. He'd allowed himself to be beguiled this day with his tour.
And his physical examination?
What the hell was that all about?
The doctor had given him an injection. A booster, he'd called it.
But what for? Against what?
Outside this shrine to technology was a mere farm, and outside that, wild animals, which his driver of the day had seemed to worship.
Druids, he thought.
In his time as a field officer in England, he'd taken the time to read books and learn about the culture of the English, played the tourist, even traveled to Stonehenge and other places, in the hope of understanding the people better. Ultimately, though, he found that history was history, and though highly interesting, no more logical there than in the Soviet Union, where history had mainly been lies concocted to fit the ideological pattern of Marxism-Leninism.
Druids had been pagans, their culture based on the gods supposed to live in trees and rocks, and to which human lives had been sacrificed. That had doubtless been a measure exercised by the Druid priesthood to maintain their control over the peasants. And the nobility too, in fact, as all religions tended to do. In return for offering some hope and certainty for the greatest mysteries of life, what happened after death, why the rain fell when it did, how the world had come to be, they extracted their price of earthly power, which was to tell everyone how to live. It had probably been a way for people of intellectual gifts but ignoble birth to achieve the power associated with the nobility. But it had always been about power, earthly power. And like the members of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, the Druid priesthood had probably believed that which they said, and that which they enforced, because they had to believe it. It had been the source of their power, and you had to believe in that. But these people here weren't primitives, were they? They were mainly scientists, some of them world leaders in their fields. Horizon Corporation was a collection of geniuses, wasn't it? How else had Breitling accumulated so much money?
Popoff frowned as he piled his plates back on the tray, then walked off to deposit them on the collection table. This was oddly like the KGB cafeteria at No. 2 Dzerzhinsky Square. Good food and anonymity. Finished, he made his way back to his room, still in the dark, as to what the hell had taken place in his life over the past months.
Druids? How could people of science be like that? Vegans? How could people of good sense not want to eat meat? What was so special about the gray-brown antelopes that lived on the margins of the property? And that man. He was the director of security here, and therefore he was supposedly a man with the highest personal trust. A fucking vegetarian in a land that produced beef in quantities the rest of the world could only dream about.
What the hell was that shot for? Popoff wondered again as he flipped on the television.
Booster? Against what?
Why had he been examined at all? The deeper he went, the more information he found, the more perplexing the puzzle became. But whatever this was all about, it had to be commensurate in scope to the investment Breitling and his company had made, and that was vast. And whatever it was about, it didn't shrink at causing the death of people unknown and clearly unimportant to John Breitling. But what possible pattern did all of that fit?
Popoff admitted yet again that he still didn't have a clue. Had he reported on this adventure to his KGB superiors, they would have thought him slightly mad, but they would have ordered him to pursue the case further until he had some sort of conclusion to present. And because he was KGB trained, he could no more stop pursuing the facts to their conclusion than he could stop breathing.
At least the first-class seats were comfortable, Chavez told himself. The flight would be a long one. About as long as a flight could be, since the destination was 10,500 miles away, and the whole planet was only 24,000 miles around. British Airways Flight 9 would be leaving at 10:15 p.m. Go 11 and three-quarter hours to Bangkok, Lay over for an hour and a half, then another 8 hours and 50 minutes to Sydney. By which time, Ding thought, he'd be about ready to pull out his pistol and shoot the flight crew. All this, plus not having his wife and son handy, just because the fucking Aussies wanted him to hold their hand during the track meet. He'd arrive at 5:20 a.m. 2 days from now due to the vagaries of the equator and the international dateline, with his body clock probably more scrambled than the eggs he had for breakfast. But there was nothing he could do about it, and at least BA had stopped smoking on their flights. Those people who did smoke would probably be going totally nuts, but that wasn't his problem. He had 4 books and 6 magazines to pass the time, plus a private TV screen for movies, and decided that he had to make the best of it. The flight attendants closed the doors, the engines started, and the captain came on the intercom to welcome them aboard their home for the next day, or 2 days, depending on how you looked at it. Chapter 32 Blood Work.
"Was that a good idea?" Breitling asked.
"I think so. Kirk was on the travel list anyway. We can have his co-workers tell anybody who asks that he was called out of town on company business," Henriksen said.
"What if the FBI agents go back to see him?"
"Then he's out of town and they'll just have to wait," Henriksen answered. "Investigations like this last for months. But there won't be months, will there?"
Breitling nodded.
"I suppose. How's Dimitri doing out there?"
"Dave Dawson says he's doing okay, asking a lot of touristy questions, but that's all. He had his physical from Johnny Kilgore, and he's gotten his B shot."
"I hope he likes being alive.
From what he said, he might turn out to be our kind of people, you know."
"I'm not so sure about that. But he doesn't know squat, and by the time he finds out, it'll be too late anyway.
Will Gearing is in place, and he says everything's going according to plan, John. 3 more weeks, and then it'll all be underway. So it's time to start moving our people to Kansas."
"Too bad. The longevity project's really looking good at the moment."
"Oh?"
"Well, it's pretty hard to predict breakthroughs, but the research threads all look very interesting at the moment, Bill."
"So we might have lived forever?" Henriksen asked, with a wry smile. For all the time he'd been associated with Breitling and Horizon Corporation, he had trouble believing such predictions. The company had caused some genuine medical miracles, but this was just too much to credit.
"I can think of worse things to happen. I'm going to make sure that whole team gets the B-shot," Breitling said.
"Well, take the whole team out there and put 'em to work in Kansas, for crying out loud," Bill suggested. "What about the rest of the company?" Breitling didn't like that question, didn't like the fact that more than half of the Horizon employees would be treated like the rest of humanity, left to die at best, or to be murdered by the A vaccine at worst. John Breitling, M.D., Ph.D., had some lingering morality, part of which was loyalty to the people who worked for him. Which was why Dmitri Popov was in Kansas with the B-class antibodies in his system. So even the big boss wasn't entirely comfortable with what he was doing, Henriksen saw. Well, that was conscience for you. Shakespeare had written about the phenomenon.
"That's already decided," Breitling said, after a second's discomfort. He'd be saving those who were part of the project, and those whose scientific knowledge would be useful in the future. Accountants, lawyers, and secretaries, by and large, would not be saved. But he'd be saving about 5,000 people, as many as the Kansas and Brazil facilities could hold, was quite a stretch, especially considering that only a small fraction of those people knew what the project was all about. Had he been a Marxist, Breitling would have thought or even said aloud that the world needed an intellectual elite to make it into the new world. But he didn't really think in those terms.
He truly did believe that he was saving the planet. And though the cost of doing so was murderously high, it was a goal worth pursuing, though part of him hoped that he'd be able to live through the transition period without taking his own life from the guilt factor that was sure to assault him. It was easier for Henriksen. What people were doing to the world was a crime. Those who did it, supported it, or did nothing to stop it, were criminals. His job was to make them stop. It was the only way. And at the end of it, the innocent would be safe, as would nature. In any case, the men and the instruments of the project were now in place. Will Gehring was confident that he could accomplish his mission. So skillfully had global security insinuated itself into the security plan for the Sydney Olympics, with the help of Popoff and his ginned-up operations in Europe. So the project would go forward, and that was that. And a year from now, the planet would be transformed. Henriksen's only concern was how many people would survive the plague. The scientific members of the project had discussed it to endless length. Most would die from starvation or other causes, and few would have the capacity to organize themselves enough to determine why the project members had also survived, and then take action against them. Most natural survivors would be invited into the protection of the elect, and the smart ones would accept that protection. The others, who cared? Henriksen had also set up the security systems at the Kansas facility. There were heavy weapons there, enough to handle rioting farmers with Shiva symptoms, he was sure.
The most likely result of the plague would be a rapid breakdown of society. Even the military would rapidly come apart, but the Kansas facility was a good distance from the nearest military base, and the soldiers based at Fort Riley would be sent to the cities first to maintain order until they too came down with symptoms. Then they'd be treated by the military doctors, for what little good it would do, and by the time unit cohesion broke down, it would be far too late for even the soldiers to take any organized action. So it would be a twitchy time, but one that would pass rapidly. And so long as the project people in Kansas kept quiet, they ought not to suffer organized attack. Hell, all they had to do was to let the world believe that people were dying there, too. Maybe dig a few graves and toss bags into them for the cameras. Better yet, burn them in the open. And they could frighten people away from another focal center of the plague. No, they'd considered this one for years. The project would succeed. It had to. Who else would save the planet? The cafeteria theme today was Italian, and Popoff was pleased to see that the cooks here were not vegans. The lasagna had meat in it. Coming out with his tray and glass of Chianti, he spotted Dr. Kilgore eating alone and decided to walk over that way.
"Ah, hello, Mr. Popoff."
"Good day, Doctor. How did my blood work turn out?"
"Fine. Your cholesterol is slightly elevated, and the HDL-LDL ratio is a little off, but I wouldn't get very upset about it. A little exercise should fix it nicely. Your PSA is fine."
"What's that?"
"A prostate-specific antibody. A check for prostate cancer. All men should check that out when they turn 50 or so. Yours is fine." "I should have told you yesterday, but I got piled up." "Sorry about that. But there was nothing important to tell you, and that's a case where no news really is good news, Mr. Popoff."
"My name is Dmitri," the Russian said, extending his hand.
"John," the doctor replied, taking it.
"Ivan to you, I guess." "And I see you are not a vegan," Dmitri Arkadyevich observed, gesturing to Kilgore's food.
"Oh, what? Me? No, Dmitri, I'm not one of those. Homo sapiens is an omnivore. Our teeth are not those of vegetarians. The enamel isn't thick enough.
that sort of a political movement, the Vegans. Some of them won't even wear leather shoes because leather's an animal product. Kilgore ate half a meatball to show what he thought of that.
I even like hunting.
Oh, where does one do that here?
Not on the project grounds. We have rules about that. But in due course, I'll be able to hunt deer, elk, buffalo, birds, everything I want, Kilgore said, looking out the huge windows.
Buffalo? I thought they were extinct, Popoff said, remembering something he'd heard or read long before.
Not really. Well, they came close 100 years ago, but enough survived to thrive at Yellowstone National Park and in private collections. Some people even breed them with domestic cattle, and the meat's pretty good. It's called buffalo. You can buy it in some stores around here.
A buffalo can breed with a cow? Popoff asked.
Sure. The animals are very close, genetically speaking, and crossbreeding is actually pretty easy.
The hard part, Kilgore explained with a grin, is that a domestic bull is intimidated by a bison cow and has trouble performing his duty, as it were. They fix that by raising them together from infancy, so the bull is used to them by the time he's big enough to do the deed.
What about horses? I would have expected horses in a place like this.
Oh, we have them, mainly quarter horses and some Appaloosas. The barn is down in the southwest part of the property.
You ride, Dmitri?
No, but I have seen many Western movies. When Dawson drove me around, I expected to see cowboys herding cattle carrying Colt pistols on their belts.
Kilgore had a good chuckle at that.
I guess you're a city boy. Well, so was I once, but I've come to love it out here, especially on horseback.
Like to go for a ride?
I've never sat on a horse, Popoff admitted, intrigued by the invitation.
This doctor was an open man and perhaps a trusting one. He could get information from this man, Dmitri Arkadyevich thought.
"Well, we have a nice, gentle quarter-horse mare. Buttermilk, would you believe?" Kilgore paused.
"Damn, it's nice to be out here."
"You a recent arrival?"
"Just last week. I used to be in the Binghamton Lab, northwest of New York City," he explained.
"What sort of work do you do?"
"I'm a physician. Epidemiologist, as a matter of fact. I'm supposed to be an expert on how diseases riffle through populations. But I do a lot of clinical stuff, too, and so I'm one of the designated family practitioners, like a GP in the old days. I know a little bit about everything, but I'm not really an expert in any field, except epidemiology, and that's more like being an accountant than a doc, really."
"I have a sister who is a physician," Popoff tried.
"Oh, where?"
"In Moscow. She's a pediatrician. She graduated Moscow State University in the 1970s. Her name is Maria Arkadyevna. I am Dmitri Arkadyevich. Our father was Arkady, you see."
"Was he a doctor, too?" Kilgore asked.
Popoff shook his head.
"No, he was like me. A spy. An intelligence officer for state security."
Popoff dropped that in to see how Kilgore would react. He figured he didn't need to keep it a secret out here. And it could be useful. You give something to get something.
"You were KGB?
"No shit," the doctor asked, impressed.
"Yes, I was. But with the changes in my country, KGB diminished in size, and I was, how you say, laid off."
"What did you do with KGB, can you say?"
It was as though he'd just admitted to being a sports star, Popoff saw. "I was an intelligence officer. I gathered information, and I was a conduit for people in whom KGB had interest."
"What does that mean?"
"Oh, I met with certain people and groups to discuss matters of mutual interest," he replied coyly.
"Like who?"
I am not supposed to say. Your Dr. Breitling knows. That is why he hired me, in fact. But you're part of the project now, right?
I do not know what that means. John sent me here, but he didn't say why.
Oh, I see. Well, you'll be here for a while, Dmitri.
That had been obvious from the facts the physician had received from New York. This Popoff guy was now part of the project, whether he wanted to be or not. He'd had his B-shot, after all. The Russian tried to recover control of the conversation.
I've heard that before. Project. What project? What exactly are you doing here?
For the first time, Kilgore looked uncomfortable.
Well, John will brief you in on that when he gets out here, Dmitri.
So, how was dinner?
The food was good, for institutional food, Popoff replied, wondering what mine he'd just stepped on.
He'd been close to something important. His instincts told him that very clearly indeed. He'd asked a direct question of someone who supposed that he'd already known the answer, and his lack of specific knowledge had surprised Kilgore.
"Yeah, we have some good people here in food services."
Kilgore finished his bread.
"So, want to take a ride in the country?"
"Yes, I'd like that very much."
"Meet me here tomorrow morning, say about 7, and I'll show you around the right way."
Kilgore walked away, wondering what the Russian was here for. Well, if John Breitling had personally recruited him, he had to be important to the project. But if that were true, how the hell could he not know what the project was all about? Should he ask someone? But if so, whom?
They knocked on the door, but there was no answer. Sullivan and Chatham waited a few minutes. They might have caught the guy on the toilet or in the shower. But there was no response. They took the elevator downstairs, found the doorman, and identified themselves.
"Any idea where Mr. McLean is?"
"He left earlier today carrying a few bags like he was going somewhere, but I don't know where."
"Cab to the airport?" Chatham asked.
The doorman shook his head.
"No, a car came for him and headed off west."
He pointed that way, in case they didn't know where west was.
"Did he do anything about his mail?"
Another headshake.
"No."
"Okay, thanks," Sullivan said, heading off to where their bureau car was parked.
"Business trip? Vacation?"
"We can call his office tomorrow to find out. It's not like he's a real suspect yet, is it, Tom?"
"I suppose not," Sullivan responded.
"Let's head off to the bar and try the photos on some more people."
"Right," Chatham agreed reluctantly.
This case was taking away his TV time at home, which was bad enough. It was also going nowhere at the moment, which was worse.
Clark awoke to the noise and had to think for a second or so to remember that Patsy had moved in with them so as not to be alone, and to have her mother's help with J.C., as they were calling him. This time he decided to get up, too, despite the early hour. Sandy was already up, her maternal instincts ignited by the sound of a crying baby. John arrived in time to see his wife hand his newly re-diapered grandson to his daughter, who sat somewhat bleary-eyed in a rocking chair purchased for the purpose, her nightie open and exposing her breast. John turned away in mild embarrassment and looked instead at his similarly nighty-clad wife, who smiled benignly at the picture before her. He was a cute little guy, Clark thought. He peeked back. JC's mouth was locked onto the offered nipple and started sucking. Maybe the only instinct human children were born with, the mother-child bond that men simply could not replicate at this stage in a child's life. What a precious thing life was. Just days before, John Connor Chavez had been a fetus, a thing living inside his mother. And whether or not he'd been a living thing depended on what one thought of abortion,
and that, to John Clark, was a matter of some controversy. He had killed in his life, not frequently, but not as seldom as he would have preferred either. He told himself at such times that the people whose lives he took had deserved their fates, either because of actions or their associations. He'd also been largely an instrument of his country at those times, and hence able to lay off whatever guilt he might have felt on a larger identity. But now, seeing J.C., he had to remind himself that every life he'd taken had started like this one had. Helpless, totally dependent on the care of his mother, later growing into a manhood determined both by his own actions and the influence of others, and only then becoming a force for good or evil. How did that happen? What twisted a person to evil? Choice? Destiny? Luck, good or bad? What had twisted his own life to the good? And was his life a servant of the good? Just one more of the damned fool things that entered your head at O Dark 30. Well, he told himself, he was sure that he'd never hurt a baby during that life, however violent parts of it had been. And he never would. No, he'd only harmed people who had harmed others first, or threatened to do so, and who had to be stopped from doing so because the others he protected, either immediately or distantly, had rights as well. And he protected them and those from harm. And that settled the thoughts for the moment. He took a step toward the pair, reached down to touch the little feet, and got no reaction, because J.C. had his priorities lined up properly at the moment. Food. And the antibodies that came with breast milk to keep him healthy. In time, his eyes would recognize faces, and his little face would smile. And he'd learn to sit up, then crawl, then walk, and finally speak, and so begin to join the world of men. Ding would be a good father and a good model for his grandson to emulate, Clark was sure, especially with Patsy there to be a check on his father's adverse tendencies. Clark smiled and walked back to bed, trying to remember exactly where Chavez the Elder was at the moment, and leaving the women's work to the women of the house. It was hours later when the dawn again awoke Popoff in his motel-like room. He'd fallen quickly into a routine, first turning on his coffee maker, then going into the bathroom to shower and shave, then coming out 10 minutes later to switch on CNN. The lead story was about the Olympics. The world had become so dull. He remembered his first field assignment to London. As in his hotel, he'd watched CNN comment and report on East-West differences, the movement of armies, and the growth of suspicion between the political groups that had defined the world of his youth. He especially remembered the strategic issues so often misreported by journalists, both print and electronic. MIRVs and missiles, and throw weight, and ABM systems that had supposedly threatened to upset the balance of power. All things of the past now, Popoff told himself. For him it was as though a mountain range had disappeared. The shape of the world had changed virtually overnight. The things he'd believed to be immutable had indeed mutated into something he'd never believed possible. The global war he'd feared, along with his agency and his nation, was now no more likely than a life-ending meteor from the heavens. It was time to learn more. Popoff dressed and headed down to the cafeteria, where he found Dr. Kilgore eating breakfast, just as promised. "Good morning, John," the Russian said, taking his seat across the table from the epidemiologist. "Morning, Dmitri. Ready for your ride?" "Yes, I think I am." "You said the horse was gentle." "That's why they call her Buttermilk. 8-year-old quarter-horse mare. She won't hurt you." "Quarter-horse? What does that mean?" "It means they only race a quarter mile, but You know, one of the richest horse races in the world is for that distance down in Texas. I forget what they call it, but the purse is huge.
Well, one more institution we won't be seeing much more of, Kilgore went on, buttering his toast.
Excuse me? Popoff asked.
Oh, nothing important, Dmitri.
And it wasn't. The horses would survive, for the most part, returning to the wild to see if they could make it after centuries of being adapted to human care. He supposed their instincts, genetically encoded in their DNA, would save most of them. And someday project members and or their progeny would capture them, break them, and ride them on their way to enjoy nature and her ways. The working horses, Quarters and Appaloosas, should do well. Thoroughbreds he was less sure of, super-adapted as they were to do one thing, run in a circle as fast as their physiology would allow, and little else. Well, that was their misfortune, and Darwin's laws were harsh, though also fair in their way. Kilgore finished his breakfast and stood.
Ready?
Yes, John.
Popoff followed him to the doors. Outside, Kilgore had his own Hummer, which he drove to the southwest in the clear, bright morning. 10 minutes later, they were at the horse barns. He took a saddle from the tack room and walked down to a stall whose door had buttermilk engraved on the pine. He opened it and walked in, quickly saddled the horse, and handed Popoff the reins.
Just walk her outside. She won't bite or kick or anything. She's very docile, Dmitri.
If you say so, John, the Russian observed dubiously.
He was wearing sneakers rather than boots, and wondered if that was important or not. The horse looked at him with her huge brown eyes, revealing nothing as to what, if anything, she thought of this new human who was leading her outside. Dmitri walked to the barn's large door, and the horse followed quietly into the clear morning air. A few minutes later, Kilgore appeared, astride his horse, a gelding, so it appeared.
"You know how to get on?" the physician asked.
Popoff figured he'd seen enough Western movies. He stuck his left foot into the stirrups and climbed up, swinging his right leg over and finding the opposite stirrup.
"Good. Now just hold the reins like this and click your tongue, like this."
Kilgore demonstrated. Popoff did the same, and the horse, dumb as she appeared to be, started walking forward. Some of this must be instinctive on his part, the Russian thought. He was doing things, apparently the right things, almost without instruction. Wasn't that remarkable?
"There you go, Dmitri," the doctor said approvingly. "This is how it's supposed to be, man. A pretty morning, a horse between your legs, and lots of country to cover."
"But no pistol," Popoff observed with a chuckle.
Kilgore did the same.
"Well, no Indians or rustlers here to kill, pal. Come on."
Kilgore's legs thumped in on his mount, making him move a little faster, and Buttermilk did the same. Popoff got his body into a rhythm similar to that of Buttermilk's and kept pace with him. It was magnificent, Dmitri Arkadyevich thought, and now he understood the ethos of all those bad movies he'd seen. There was something fundamental and manly about this, though he lacked a proper hat as well as a six-gun. He reached into his pocket and took out his sunglasses, looked around at the rolling land, and somehow felt himself to be a part of it all.
"John, I must thank you. I have never done this before. It is wonderful," he said sincerely.
"It's nature, man. It's the way things were always supposed to be.
Come on, Mystic," he said to his mount, speeding up a little more, looking back to see that Popoff could handle the increased pace. It wasn't easy to synchronize his body movements in pace with the horse, but gradually Popoff managed it, and soon pulled up alongside.
"So, this is how Americans settled the West?"
Kilgore nodded.
"Yep. Once this was covered with buffalo, three or four great herds, as far as the eye could see. Hunters did it all in a period of about 10 years, using single-shot Sharps buffalo guns mainly. They killed them for the hides to make blankets and stuff, for the meat. Sometimes they killed them just for the tongues. Slaughtered them like Hitler did with the Jews. Kilgore shook his head. One of the greatest crimes America ever committed, Dmitri. Just killed them just 'cause they were in the way. But they'll be coming back, he added, wondering how long it would take. 50 years? He'd have a fair chance of seeing it then. Maybe 100 years. They'd be letting the wolves and barren grounds grizzly come back too, but predators would come back slower. They didn't breed as rapidly as their prey animals. He wanted to see the prairie again as it had once been. So did many other project members, and some of them wanted to live in teepees like the Indians had done. But that, he thought, was a little bit extreme. Political ideas taking the place of common sense. "Hey, John!" a voice called from a few hundred yards behind. Both men turned to see a figure galloping up to them. In a minute or so, he was recognizable. "Kirk, when did you get out here?" "Flew in last night," McLean answered. He stopped his horse and shook hands with Kilgore. "What about you?"
"Last week, with the Binghamton crew. We closed that operation down and figured it was time to pull up stakes."
"All of them?" McLean asked in a way that got Popoff's attention. "All of who?"
"Yep," Kilgore nodded soberly.
"Schedule workout?" McLean asked next, dismissing whatever it was that had upset him before. "Almost perfectly on the projections. We, helped the last ones along."
"Oh."
McLean looked down for a second, feeling bad, briefly, for the women he'd recruited. But only briefly.
"So it's moving forward?"
"Yes, it is, Kirk. The Olympics start day after tomorrow, and then..."
"Yeah. Then it starts for real."
"Hello," Popoff said, after a second. It was as though Kilgore had forgotten he was there.
"Oh, sorry, Dmitri. Kirk McLean, this is Dmitri Popoff. John sent him out to us a couple days ago."
"Howdy, Dmitri." Handshakes were exchanged.
"Russian?" McLean asked.
"Yes."
A nod.
"I work directly for Dr. Breitling. And you?"
"I'm a small part of the project," McLean admitted.
"Kirk's a biochemist and environmental engineer," Kilgore explained. "Also so good-looking that we had him do another little thing for us," he teased. "But that's over now."
"So what broke you loose so early, Kirk?"
"Remember Mary Bannister?"
"Yeah, what about her?"
"The FBI asked me if I knew her. I kicked it around with Henriksen, and he decided to send me out a little early."
"I take it she's..."
Kilgore nodded matter-of-factly.
"Yeah, last week."
"So A works?"
"Yes, it does."
"And so does B."
"That's good. I got my B shot already."
Popoff thought back to his injection at Kilgore's hands. There had been a capital B on the vial label, hadn't there? And what was this about the FBI? These two were talking freely, but it was like a foreign language. No, it was the speech of insiders, using internal words and phrases as engineers and physicians did. Well, as intelligence officers did as well. It was part of Popoff's fieldcraft to remember whatever was said in front of him, however distant from his understanding. And he took it all in, despite his befuddled expression. Kilgore led his horse off again.
"First time out, Kirk?"
"First time on a horse in months. I had a deal with a guy in New York City, but I never really had time to do it enough. My legs and ass are going to be sore tomorrow, John." The bioengineer laughed.
"Yeah, but it's a good kind of sore." Kilgore laughed as well. He'd had a horse back in Binghamton, and he hoped that the family that kept it for him would let him out when the time came, so that Stormy would be able to feed himself. But then Stormy was a gelding, and therefore biologically irrelevant to the entire world.